everybody. Welcome to the Hunter's Quest podcast. This is your host, Hunter McWaters. It's good to be with you guys. And I just got back from Spain hunting with Pedro and had a great time. If you want to hear all about that hunt, we did a really cool recap podcast that released last week. So go check that out. I want to mention a couple things real quick before we jump into this week's episode, which is a good one. Firstly, you got about one more week left to enter the CVA Acura giveaway. And all you got to do to get entered in that is go to my YouTube channel, watch my first elk hunt film, which I released a couple weeks ago, which is awesome. It has almost 100,000 views already and counting. And right now, you got about a 1 in 300 chance of winning. All you got to do is go on there, subscribe to my channel, and leave a comment, like the video, and you're going to get entered to win. I'm going to randomly select one of those comments to win a brand new CVA Acura of your choice in about another week. So get on there. If you haven't yet, check out the film, subscribe, like the video, and leave a comment. The other thing I wanted to mention real quick is today is Sunday, Tuesday night. That'll be July 2nd. If you have Sportsman Channel, I really hope you'll tune in to the Season 2 premiere of the Hunter's Quest TV show. Again, that's on Sportsman Channel. It's going to be Tuesday, July 2nd at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. That's 5:30 p.m. Mountain. And I'm excited about this new time slot. Hopefully more folks can join in after work. So again, if you got Sportsman Channel or, you know, set your DVR, tune in July 2nd, 7:30 p.m. Eastern or 5:30 Mountain on Sportsman Channel. This week I got a really great episode with a new friend of mine who I'm going to be doing some collaboration with, a guy named Tosh Collins. He's a leader in the Native American community and a really cool guy, a fitness content creator, hunter, and kind of a wellness author. He's got a book out. And just like I said, a leader in the indigenous community and a really great guy. So I hope you guys enjoy this conversation. It's very unique. We dive into some topics and some themes that aren't addressed a whole lot in the space. And then I'm looking forward to collaborating with Tosh later this year on a hunt, actually, which I'm really looking forward to and kind of learning some of his practices. So hope you guys enjoy this episode. It's a really great conversation. I think you will. Let's jump right in. Thanks for your support, and we'll see you on the next one. All right, everybody, welcome to the Hunter's Quest podcast. This is your host, Hunter McWaters. Today, I'm here with a new friend, Mr. Tosh Collins. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good, man. Thanks for having me. I'm just honored. Looking forward to this.
Yeah, man. It's good to talk to you. We spoke on the phone about a week ago or so. And just to give listeners some context, I found your account kind of randomly. I think it was through the Canis Athlete page. And I just saw your stuff looked really cool. And then I saw some of the reels you posted, some of the fitness routines you do. And I was like, whoa, this guy's cool. And I wanted to talk to you. And then, you know, on a larger scale, for a long time, and we talked about this a little bit, I've been wanting to speak with someone who's kind of a leader in the, do you guys say First Nation here?
Or is that Canadian? Like just leader in the Native community and
yeah, okay.
Yep, general Native community. Yep.
Right. And also somebody who hunts and somebody in like, I saw your content. It looked really cool. The fitness stuff. And so, I had tabled that cause I just didn't really know anybody, that kind of fit the bill for a while. Then I saw you, I was like, man, I really want to talk to this guy. So thanks for coming on, man. I appreciate your time.
Yeah. You know, when you first contacted me to talk about some of the topics that you're interested in, you know, I immediately became interested as an indigenous person, a native person who peeks into this mainstream hunting community. As I like to say, I peek in and I look and I watch and I observe and I learn things, and there's a lot of people out there creating content that I have a lot of respect for, that I enjoy watching their content. But there's not any indigenous Native American First Nation people within that whole space. And I think we get referenced a lot, you know, especially on some of the bigger platforms, such as, you know, Meat Eater, you hear reference of indigenous people's original hunting practices. If you follow Cam Haines, he goes and hunts during the bull rut over there in San Carlos Apache,
Yeah.
just a couple hours east of here.
Right.
And he talks a little bit about what he learns from those people. So you get, I feel you get, people within the mainstream hunting community get hints of little bits of knowledge about
Yeah.
indigenous people, who we were on this land, and what hunting is to us, and in conjunction to our general indigenous culture and food ways. So when you told me you were interested in this, I became immediately was ready
Yeah.
to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I said to you too before is like as a person who enjoys, creation and nature and spends a lot of time out west in lands that were at one time native lands and and I'm very well acquainted with, I love America. This is a great country, but we're not perfect and one of the biggest blemishes on our history is our relations with the First Nations, Indigenous people of our country. And so, I feel like we lost a lot in that. We lost a lot of, just opportunity to learn from one another. And so, yeah, that's why one reason I wanted to make inroads with you and talk to you and just kind of, just to learn some stuff from you and just have some conversations. Like you said, just there's not many guys like you in the space, so it's a interesting conversation.
And let me start by giving your listeners some context too about where I come from and who I am, and
Sure,
then I
yeah.
can speak to some of these topics right here that are really important. And you asked a really good question when we first introduced ourselves over the phone. You said, how do I word this? What's the appropriate way to ask, what nation you are? And that's exactly what I said. It's appropriate to ask when you see Native people, you ask them, oh, what indigenous nation are you? Oh, you're Native American? Okay, what nation are you? And typically you would hear tribe, right? You would
Right.
hear, oh, hey, what tribe are you? Or they're this tribe or that tribe. And that's a term that's still being utilized, throughout Native countries, particularly by our older generations. Like our elder generation still use tribe. They still use the word Indian. But I would say since in the recent years, in the past couple of decades, there's a big movement amongst the younger generation to adopt different terminology and language about identifying ourselves within the context of English language, with consideration to the colonial period that had enculturated us into dominant society. So there's a movement to change the language and to utilize our original names that we called ourselves before Euro-Americans had colonized some of the territories, which wasn't very long ago. In terms of the entire, retrospect of timeline of which humans have been living, the time in which indigenous people have been living in this post-colonial period is really small. I would say if there's 100 yards, you have the last 3 yards that we've been living in this period. So we're looking at the big picture. So it's a good thing to ask when Native people, indigenous person, hey, what nation are you? Oh, you're Native? Okay, what nation are you? You can say those very, very casually. And if you're in Canada, you could still use that term, but up there they tend to also use the term First Nations. And you can say it down here too. It's just less common. It is not any wrong or right way. And then somebody will tell you, a Native person like myself, if you ask me, oh, Itasho, so what Native nation are you? What indigenous nation are you? And then I would say, oh, okay, yeah, so I grew up on the Anakamir to Autham community, the Salt River. Our government name is Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community, but Pima is not our original name. And Pima is a name we got when the Spaniards first came here in the 1500s. They said, ¿Cómo se llama? What are your names? What do you call yourselves? They were saying. And in our language, obviously, we didn't understand that. So the Autumn, the people here in modern day Arizona, Sonora, Mexico, they would say, Piñamaj, Piñamaj. I don't know what you mean. Piñamaj, I don't understand. And with their Spanish accent, it went from Piñamaj to Pima. And then the federal government adopted that and they call us, okay, you guys are the Pimas. And we get known as that. And it goes on for generations. And our own people start calling ourselves that. think at some point, culture leaders who have more of our original thinking, they'll say, wait a minute, that's not our name though. That's what the colonizers call us. We originally called ourselves An-Akimer-Ta-O-Atam. O-Atam means a person, Akimer is a river, and An is salt. So we are the people who lived along the Salt River. Present day, Phoenix, the city of Phoenix, Tempe, Mesa, Scottsdale, that's all on our ancestral territory. So we lived along that river, and today that river is the river that provides water to most of the state. It goes on up to the Colorado River, goes south. It provides water to parts of Southern California, parts of Nevada, all that. So like these down here in the Southwest, Arizona, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, parts of Nevada, parts of California, all share water from the same source, which comes from that Colorado table, from the Colorado Mountains, also from the Gila National Forest in eastern New Mexico, just above the Apache Reservation. So that's who I am. That's where I grew up. And so the reservation I grew up is called Salt River. And that's just the English word. And that's on my dad's side. My mom's side, she's from Oklahoma, and she is Wajaji, also known as Osage. And people kind of found out about the Osage people from the film that came out last year, Killers of the Flower Moon, the Martin
Oh,
Scorsese
yeah, I
film.
saw that.
Yeah, that was about my mom's side. That's where she grew up, on that reservation.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yes, and then that's her dad. Her mom was from the people who are originally came out from upstate New York area, and they were Seneca and Cayuga, and they were part of the what people known as the Iroquois Confederacy, but more so traditionally known as the Haudenosaunee, which is people of the woodlands, people of the longhouses. And some of them got pushed out of their lands and moved down to Indian Territory in Oklahoma. So that's
Gotcha.
a lot of Native people. When you talk to them, they're going to give you a really long, a long explanation about who they are, because we're so tied to our land. We're so tied to the ancestors that walked before us, because in our perspective, it wasn't that long ago. Some people might say, oh, that was 200 years ago. But in our worldview, and in terms of our relation to this interconnected web of life in this land, that's a really short period. So we still really identify, we see ourselves as a continuum of our ancestor, a continuation, even an extension of the land itself, the Jivut, the Mother Earth. So that's when you ask a native person, they're going to give you this big long explanation about who they are, how many nations they come from, where they were raised.
And I feel like looking at it from that perspective of, like you said, the history of your people so long, and even though, in modern minds it might seem like it's been a long time since, the 1700s or whatever, it's a relative blink of an eye. And it almost seems to me like because of what happened to your people from colonialization, from disease, etc., loss of land, etc., etc., it's almost like the people are still staggering, like trying to figure, like reeling from this massive shock. And I see guys like you emerging to kind of take back some of what was lost. So, I don't know,
Yeah, I'm
could you
glad you
speak to
see
that at all?
that. Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you see that. That's a big part of our work that I do myself and my wife Chelsea. She's from the Standing Rock Lakota people on her paternal side, and her maternal side, she's Turtle Mountain Chippewa and up in North Dakota. And so together we do indigenous wellness work, and it's a part of the general movement in native country, both US and Canada. There's a general movement to heal from what you said is what the world recognizes is historic trauma. When you said they're still staggering and reeling from what happened, that's historic trauma or intergenerational trauma, and that those terms were coined, I believe, in the early 90s. And those are terms that are pretty well understood within the native community. They're pretty well understood amongst indigenous people who are living through and have dealt with colonial occupations, throughout the world, such as the people in Hawaii. We have relations to those indigenous people there. The organization I work with, we have relations to Maori people in New Zealand,
Oh,
as
cool.
well as many different Aboriginal nations in Australia. And so we all, amongst that, this global community of indigenous people who are trying to heal and restore their identity, the terms of intergenerational trauma, historic trauma are pretty well understood. But I see in dominant society, these are not really that understood. And it is for sure by design. I think that one of the mainstream narratives in the US, it is to their benefit to keep a lot of Americans from really truly understanding the depths of historic intergenerational trauma and how it continues from generation. And this is science. This isn't just a narrative that indigenous people created to, ask for a handout. This is the science. This is well studied throughout the world,
Oh, yeah.
peer-reviewed evidence
It's like
that shows.
epigenetics, right?
I was going to get to that next. Epigenetics, the trauma, the grief that is experienced, multi-layered, they
Yeah.
say, or it's collectively experienced or indirectly experienced. Therefore, say a loved one who raised you went through a collective or went through historic trauma and grief, such as through the boarding school where indigenous people were forced to go to boarding schools to become acculturated into dominant society. They might go on and they come out and they experience lots of various types of abuse, like sexual abuse, at the hands of the educators, which was ran by the church, state-sponsored. That's coming to surface as well. There is national efforts, within the Department of Interior to bring light to that and educate that and investigate that. So say someone comes out of that, they have children and they perpetuate those sometimes behaviors to the next generation. And epigenetics again shows when they experience trauma and grief through what you're seeing, what you're hearing, what you're feeling, your overall experience changes the nervous system, changes the brain chemistry. And that is undisputed within the scientific community. PTSD. I think most people in America understand it when it's PTSD with soldiers, but there's some evidence showing that children of residential schools also experience the same level of PTSD. So they grow up with that. And so that's what historic intergenerational trauma is. And our work to pull it right back out, I had to zoom in a little bit to pull it out. There's a general movement across the world to heal from historic intergenerational trauma and to revitalize our identity, our life ways, our culture, because much of our culture and our cultural practices, our languages, our ceremonies, our social structures, much of it is still intact and passed on because of our resilience. But there's a lot of little things that we sort of, I guess, for lack of a better way of saying it, sort of lost and is not being practiced, and we're trying to revitalize, and we're also trying to recreate it. And so that's the work that I do alongside my wife. We have an indigenous wellness initiative called Well for Culture, and we have a healing model that we use to do trainings with a native country. It's a template, and it's called Seven Circles. It's food ways, it's sleep, it's physical movement, it's ceremony, which is about stress relief, sacred space, connection to land, and connection to community. Those seven aspects of our life are what our ancestors did in pre-colonial times to thrive, and it helps with spiritual, physical, mental, and emotional states of being. And we wrote a book on this. It came out on HarperCollins in October of 2022, called The Seven Circles: Indigenous Teachings for Living Well. And we wrote this for people of all walks of life to benefit from. And it's just a really general template. And we encourage people to look into these different circles. What are you doing in these various aspects to help with your overall health? How much sleep are you getting? How much physical movement are you doing? How much more are you connecting to your food than just counting protein, fat, carbohydrate? Are you out there harvesting it? And that's where I think hunting is a big part. Hunting intersects with connection to land, community, because you're doing that ceremony. If you have words of giving of thanks, if you have prayer, you do for the harvest. Ceremony is a part of that. So that's our wellness model. That's the work that we do. And so with the content I share on social media, it's about exactly what you said. It's really showing, I'm trying to show, as a native person, this is how you live a healthy, well lifestyle in this contemporary world. And you can do it by the way of our ancestral teachings, but it looks different. I got a compound bow in the back, but I got a couple of traditional war clubs, and it's blending, it's a hybrid, it's an understanding of that we adopt different things from, Western technology that we feel will help us to play out and live the role, you know, that we want to live. So that's what my social media content is. It's fitness, it's health, it's getting out on the land to hunt, to forage, to grow food, and showing how does all that fit together? How does that look? You know, that should contribute to me as a man. It's allowing me to play a role within my family. We have 2 children, 3 and 6, mm-hmm. and playing a role within family, but also within the greater community. I do a lot of stuff in my community. I'm the vice chairman for the land management board. Also do a lot of just grassroots community work with healing. And I'm one of the singers in our community. So we sing at a lot of different events and stuff like that. And so that's awesome. Again, that's just kind of the long of what I do and what I share and how it's all connected.
Yeah. So I think it's funny. I mean, if you really go back far enough, we were all indigenous people somewhere at some point. Yeah. So, you know, I feel like you said, those 7 circles, those principles can be applied to anyone really. I mean, I think we've obviously Native American situation is very unique to that particular situation, but we've all lost, you know, speaking broadly about society, we've all lost our, for the most part, our connection to land, to ceremony, to that's awesome, man. But so tell me like a little bit about yourself personally, like, because you speak your language, correct? And you grew up on the reservation, I believe, and so talk to me how you personally were able to kind of rise above some of the stuff that is creating some of this trauma or perpetuating some of this trauma, and get to where you are. And then I'd love to hear more just details from your life about what it's like trying to maintain and thrive in your historical, you know, culture and practices, but also being in this completely different culture and society, and what's that like?
Yeah, that's a great question for sure. Yeah, these are great questions and great topics, and to me that you have enough perspective and vision to ask these kind of questions shows me that your worldview is big and expanded, and I like that, and I that's what I would hope for more people in dominant society to be curious to have critical thought and sort of understand there's a lot I don't understand. Yeah. And I think that that's a good way to go about. I don't see enough of that in dominant society. I see a lot of people who don't know what they don't know, and they're speaking in absolutes and, you know, spewing very harmful rhetoric and misinformation and just spewing ideology that isn't conducive to even Christianity, to the cultures of the world. That's what I see a lot in dominant society. So when I meet you and you have these questions, I said, that's good. I like that he's thinking. And, you know, my experience growing up on the reservation is, I didn't even realize that until a handful of years ago that we were living below the poverty line on the reservation in the late 80s. I was born in 82. And my mom came from Oklahoma in the 70s. My father, you know, met her, and they both were sort of, you know, raised, of course, in families where they're exposed to a lot of our cultural knowledge, but also exposed to things like addiction. Mm-hmm. You know, addiction is one of the symptoms of historic trauma, intergenerational grief. My father had to go to boarding school. So when he came out of boarding school, he didn't speak the language that much because they were punished for speaking the language in boarding school. So he would come back home to his mom and his grandparents, and they would, his father wasn't around. Which is why he got into a lot of trouble, which is why one of the reasons they sent him off to boarding school. He came back and he didn't know the language as much. And, you know, and he fell into addiction for a little while and came out of it when he was seeing some other men in the community that were starting to be curious, what is our original identity? Who are our original people? Because back then in the 60s, 70s, you'd still hear the language a lot. But a lot of people had converted to Christianity, so they didn't really know a lot about our ceremonies, our songs, our dances, our spiritual worldview. It was in pockets throughout the community. So my dad was a part of this circle who went out there. They sought it out to ask these different elders this knowledge, and some of them were just keeping and hanging on to this knowledge. So he got on this journey with in Native countries, they say they're getting on a red road. They're putting away, so they're getting on the sobriety journey. They are learning about their identity, and they're living as a Native American. And that's what my father had did. He met my mom,
Nice.
and they had me in 82, and we were on the reservation living in some of my dad's families on the reservation. What happens is that when a reservation is broken up between allotted land, which land that's given out to different community members is dispersed, and then it gets fractionated because as they have children, they split it up, they pass on, those children split up. So you have like checkerboarded and fractionated land on the reservation. So my dad had got a little bit of land given to him from his grandparents, and all of our family lived in this one area. So I grew up on the reservation in Salt River with four sisters, three brothers, something like that. And my mom had a couple of kids. My dad had a few kids. They got together, had three more. So big, a wild household. Our cousins lived next to us, our aunties, everybody, uncles. There was about six, seven families living in down a dirt road on the reservation. And we played together. We grew up a lot there. And one of the first things that we did in terms of indigenous cultural foodways was hunt. My dad always took us out. I started getting out there with my dad in the mountains. Six, seven, I started, shooting guns. Yeah, five, six, seven, or something like that. A little 22,
Yeah,
and
same.
we got out there and first hunted a cottontail. That's what the young boys do here
Me too.
culturally.
My first animal was a cottontail with a bow, actually.
Nice. Yeah, and that's good, and that's the way to do it. And that's, to me, that's the beauty I see between all the cultures, is that as sort of the milestones in a coming of age rites of passage for young boys, is they learn to hunt, they learn to make a harvest, they learn to gut that animal, they learn to cook it and share it. So we started getting out there, hunting cottontail, quail. A javelina was my first, big game, was considered big game here. That was my first, big game kill at 12. And then I was able to go. I've been on some, muley hunts of my dad around that time. I first started. I remember my first one. I remember it was seven. That's why I have that old one in the back, because I was with my dad there. I was about 8 or 9
That was your
when we
first
shot.
year?
They shot this big buck with my dad there.
Nice.
And so I have that, just sort of, that's that sort of memory.
Yeah.
So yeah, we started hunting, and we hunted all the animals that our ancestors did. Like I said, cottontail, the chuv, jackrabbit, the javelina, the mule deer buck, and that was what we hunted. And so we
Quick
did a lot of
question.
that growing up there. On
Does jackrabbit taste as good as cottontail?
It tastes about the same.
Same.
I think cottontail tastes a little bit better,
They're
but
so good. They're like so underrated. Rabbit
yeah,
is
they
so
are. They're
nice.
good. I think just for the little bit of meat they yield, people don't, like to
Yeah.
do the work. But back in the day here, that's what would the even the mamas and the grandmas would they would go out in the back and get a cottontail and cook,
Yeah.
make a soup up right there. Like that was one of
Yep.
the things they did pretty regularly.
Yeah.
So yeah, we
One more question, real quick, about food.
yeah.
Just because I don't know if I'll get a chance to ask you later, but I've
Yeah.
listened to this audiobook, and it's talking mainly about Apache, which I realize you're not Apache, but they were talking about this bread that they would make out of mesquite. Have you heard of that?
Yeah,
Do
we
people
do
still
that
make that?
too. We do that too. And so mesquite creates a bean, which is going to be coming up here
Yeah.
pretty soon in a couple of months. Mesquite pods, they dry up, and before they hit the ground, there's a time you got to get out there and harvest them. And they grind them up, they coarse
Yeah.
grind them up, and you can make various consistencies of them. You can make it as like a pudding. And this is what the warriors would have. They'd make a little sack or a gourd, and they put that powder, that ground up, they ground up on the
Like fl
we call it vioho chui or kui chui, but it's like a powder, or what some
Like a
people
flower
call
kind
it.
of.
Yeah, it's a flour. You can mix it in water to make it like a thin drink. You can make it a thick pudding, and you can bake it. They would add like ash and a little bit of like animal fat, and they'd bake it on a cake, like on coals or a hot rock. So it makes this cake really high in carbohydrates, really high in fiber. It was a great food that kept the runners or warriors on the go. They would have that.
Nice.
So yeah, and it's bitter and sweet. There's a little bit of bitterness to it. It's chalky at first, and it's all about the consistency, about how much water you mix with it. But
Interesting.
yeah, we did the same thing. Apaches, we share a lot of the same territory, so we've a lot of the same cultural life ways, but they had spanned more towards east and into the pine forest area. And historically, we used to fight with them until we made a peace treaty in the late 1800s with them.
Okay. Anyway,
Yeah.
rabbit trail, but
yeah.
So you're growing and up, starting to hunt.
Yeah, we grew up and getting out to hunt, and my dad was getting sober, so he was bringing us around a lot of the cultural gatherings in the community, like a girl's coming of age ceremony, the young men's coming of age ceremony. Came back later on. We'd go to social dances where they would sing the songs and everybody would get together and social round dance, and so I grew up in that way, and I went to art high school and went away to college in San Francisco in 2001, and that's where I first veered off my path. You know, I was like a res kid coming into the city, and I got a Fulbright scholarship to do photography there. And that's where I got exposed to alcohol, drugs, and things like that, and I went on that path for a little bit. And I always knew, though, yeah, I always knew that it wasn't for me, and I was just a visitor in the city. So when I came home, I was starting to get, you know, old enough to really see the alcoholism that was really taking hold of people. And then diabetes became more prevalent. I would say late 90s, I would start to see more and more prevalence of type 2 diabetes, which we know is it's a symptom. I would say in general, all the modern diseases like addiction,
yeah,
cardiovascular disease, neurodegenerative diseases, metabolic disorders such as type 2 diabetes, those are symptoms of grief and trauma. Those are physical manifestations of people who have been removed from their original way of life,
yes,
put into this dominant society. You have the food removed, you have this age of convenience, age of plenty, you have that compounded with grief and trauma from a loss of the river,
yeah,
the loss of, you know, being secluded to just one part of the land for a lot of years. That culminates into historic trauma, and grief turns into addiction, all these things. So that's why there might seem like a higher prevalence of, yeah, of addiction.
It's like trying to fill that void that was created, yeah, you know, just like anybody does with, yeah, addiction, which I've struggled, yeah, with in my past too. So,
yeah. So, you know, it's an addiction for those that don't know, it's a disease. It's categorized as a disease. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a beast, and you know, I've dealt with a lot of that in my family, and so we've lost many family members to it. And so you know, I was able to start to kind of see that in my late teens. I was wondering, you know, asking my dad, how come no longer this man, and he doesn't bring his son to the gatherings? Because we had a men's circle. We would do the things that the men would do back in the day. And it was a way to us to try to heal and, yeah, for men to kind of learn their role within community once again. And we used to do camps, and we would run from one place to another for a cause. We would do what people call now cold plunge. And that's something historically a lot of Native Americans would do in the wintertime. And we wrote about this story a little bit in our book. But the older men would encourage the young men, the children, the boys, at dawn in the coldest parts of the winter to get out and dunk themselves in the water, because they said it would toughen them up for life. It would toughen their skin.
Yeah.
And it would, you know, and what they're saying is it would create more grit for their overall personality, the character. And to run, we would fast, and then we would run for, you know, we did these 10 or 12, 13 mile runs from one sacred location to another for a certain cause. And that was all about character development. Mm. And so we were a part of that. And then I would see a lot of men would get involved, and then over the years they would just drop off. And I'd talk to my dad, hey, what happened? Well, so-and-so's in jail. They fell off the wagon. They're struggling, you know, with addiction, or so-and-so's on dialysis now, so they don't have a lot of energy to come out. So in my mind, early on as a teen, it taught me, I was starting to see the collective degradation of health taking a hold on the people, and which is why I became, later on, I would become more passionate about, you know, health and wellness and healing. And then I would get involved with larger organizations throughout Native country who were doing this healing work in Native country. So now I also sit on the board of the Native Wellness Institute, and they also do work within different parts of Native country, provide technical assistance for ways of healing through those people's life ways. So we help assist with that. But that's how it was growing up on the reservation. I moved to the city for a while in San Francisco. I moved down to Los Angeles. And then about 2011, I came back to the reservation. And when I left to go to the cities, it was always in my mind that I was just a visitor to those places. And I was on other indigenous people's land. And that was, my goal was always to come back home and to contribute, to be with community again, and give back what was given to me. There was a way that was paved for me growing up. And so that's what I'm doing today. And I came back to be a part of that, met my wife, and, you know, we started our, I met her in like 2012, and we ended up getting together in 2015. And we created our initiative around that time as well.
Is she part of your nation as well?
What's that?
Is she a part of your nation as well?
No, she's standing around Lakota and Turnamon, Chippewa.
You said that, I think.
Yeah, from North Dakota. And so, you know, just to answer your question, it was, I think for me, just having, being exposed to our original culture when I was younger, it set a baseline for how to live a healthy life. And like I said, in my early 20s, I veered off my path. And I would go and I would live in cities, like I said, San Francisco, Los Angeles. I did photography. I worked in a little bit of the entertainment. I worked with other Native people. I drank alcohol, did substances, partied around. I always was active and I always had a general sense of like how to eat right. And I quit alcohol about 11 years ago. So nice. I was like 12 years ago or something like that. I was like 31. I'm 42 now. I quit then, and I always knew it wasn't for me. I always knew that drinking wasn't it wasn't part of our spiritual life ways. It wasn't a part of our cultural teachings. We didn't have alcohol as right. Native Americans. And so there was always my goal. I said, you know, I'm going to quit and I'm going to be married. I'm going to be a father, and I don't want them to see this side of me. So I quit and I got on a healing journey, and I came back to the reservation, and I had a different outlook on the reservation because I lived in different places, and I seen what we have on the reservation. I seen all this beauty that we have to land, to knowledge, to how to live a good life. And I became really passionate again about learning the language again, learning the songs, learning the food ways, being a part of ceremony. And that was so, it would, to answer your question, it was the cultural teachings that brought me back, that kept me from, you know, going down the path of becoming addicted or diabetic or incarcerated, you know, like a lot of other Native men, unfortunately, fall victim to. So that's the long answer to your question.
Oh, that's right, awesome. There. And it sounds like your dad, you know, played a really big role in like kind of breaking some of those cycles, you know. So that's awesome that he was able to do that.
Absolutely.
I was going to say, my family, you know, we alcoholism is big thing in my family. My dad's parents and my mom's parents were alcoholics. They did get sober, and then, but you know, I think in a lot of ways my dad was responsible, similar to yours, with and kind of breaking that cycle, and got me into the outdoors and stuff like that. So and then now you're able to be that person for your daughters, and also, you know, hopefully young men in your community and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you have the right mindset. I think that's the mindset we all share, of regardless of where we were raised or what our political affiliation and what our religious orientation is. I think one thing that we should really all connect upon is the similarities, that we all want to pass on something to the next generation. We all want to break cycles. We want more for our children and their children than we had. So I like your thinking, and that's exactly, in our culture, we call it seven generation thinking, because you're thinking that what you are doing right now will have an impact for seven generations down the line, whether it be good or bad.
Yeah.
So it teaches pragmatic thinking. It teaches to have a vision, to know that what I'm doing today, this very moment, how I make my child feel is going to have a ripple effect for generations. What I teach them is going to have a ripple effect for generations on the land as well. So, you know, you're absolutely right. Like, my father broke cycles. And when I was on my healing journey, first getting on that, I had really examined that, you know, what are the cycles he brought? What cycles that he didn't break am I perpetuating? And how do I break those?
Yeah.
And in place of that, we can't just break cycles. We have to replace them, right? We have to make healthy life ways the norm. Mm-hmm. So I'm always thinking of that in my parenting, in my fathering. And as you said, in my mentoring of other young men in my community, other Native men, trying to, you know, really make that positive impact and show them what I think to be a healthy man is. What is masculinity? It's love, it's giving, it's strength, it's resilience, it's pragmatic thinking, it's empathy, it's physical strength, but it's also grit, it's mental grit, you know, it's intelligence, all that.
Yeah. And, you know, playing your part in writing some of that, you know, generational trauma, not just for yourself. You know, it's interesting and it's cool because it starts within yourself. But then, like you said, it can have ripple effects through your whole community and then even generations to come. And then, you know, maybe in the next generation, there's 10 guys like you. And then there's 100, you know. And and then, you know, maybe the entire face of your community is completely changed, you know.
Right.
So that's awesome, man. Talk to me a little bit about kind of, like I said, finding balance in, because I can imagine, like, you know, there may have been a phase where, you know, you're starting to learn the depth of your culture and the depth of what was lost. And then I can imagine that's kind of overwhelming and depressing probably at first. But then like figuring out how to like work through that and remain positive and not let it destroy you, but how to hold on. And I mean like practically even like how you do your spiritual practice, like how to remain connected to those things that are important but also, you know, function within society and be a positive person.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, again, that shows me you have very, you know, you have visionary thinking to be able to see that and to be able to know that that's a question. And that's a big discussion in Native country for decades now. It started in the 1960s, you know, around the civil rights movement. Also what emerged out of that as being inspired by that civil rights movement was the Red Power movement. So Native American activists were standing up and saying that, hey, Black people are speaking out against racial inequality, and we have that too. So we're going to also speak out alongside them against federal government and the policies they had placed, really policies that would strain tribal to federal government relations. You know, they would try to hinder growth. And it's still like that today. A lot of people don't understand that. They think we get handouts. They think we don't pay taxes. They think we get free college. That's not true. We can talk about that later too, if you want. But as Native Americans, we faced a lot of policies. It was illegal to, I believe it was 1973 or 74. It was illegal for us to practice our cultural and spiritual practices.
No way.
And this is in a country that's supposed to be, you know, freedom is a big part of your democracy.
That's crazy.
And a lot of Americans don't understand that. In the 1970s, you know, our parents were alive. We have stories, elders tell stories of, say, that they would go to a house in the middle of the night to do a ceremony, you know, to do it in secret so they didn't get prosecuted.
Wow.
So a lot of people don't understand that. That's just one of them. You know, that's a big topic to talk about. But, you know, so that's also contributes to the collective trauma and grief as well. Mm-hmm. So going forward today, you know, that's a big topic. You know, Native Americans have always spoke out against, you know, the inequality that we are experiencing from federal government. It's gotten much better in the recent, really just past 5, 6, 7, 8 years that we've seen some progress in nation to nation relationship between tribal government and federal government. And so it has always been a challenge for us to maintain our cultural identity in a world where the values seem to clash with our own. Mm-hmm. Dominant society values at many times clash with our own. We are now, as Native people, really as all human beings, we live very close to the land. We live together in units. We did things together. We have clan systems. We have a social structure. We did things on the land. Now we're all separated. Policy separates most of us. And people in dominant society, you and I spoke briefly to it, is that we don't have the help of our families. Now we're all sort of spread out. In the old days, we lived in clusters. So all of the mamas worked together, and the grandmas took care of the babies while the men did their work. The men were able to do their things, go and tend to the fields, to go hunt, to protect the village. Now we're in disarray. We're figuring out how do we live in this world where we're all separated and we have to make it a point to see each other and to be relatives. That's a big challenge.
Americans is a challenge, especially in America, because my wife is Middle Eastern and she's always talking about, it's like, you know, we're very, and again, I don't want people to think I'm talking trash about America. I love America, but you know, we have our problems like anything else. And one of the things I think we could do better is, I think COVID made it worse, but we were already like this, you know, especially in suburban areas. You know, you have your, you have your 1 acre, you have your house, you have your family. It's kind of there. There's, it's, you have to be, in our society, you have to be very intentional about building community, or else you won't at all. Like you could live your whole life and not even know the guy next door unless you like try. So that's something we need to do, but it's an area I feel like, especially in America, just even just the way our towns are like built, due to like the automobile is, you know, in the Middle East, cities are thousands of years old. The infrastructure is designed for walking. Here, like, I'll die if I try to walk to the store, you know, like you can't. And like, so people aren't out about, and, so it's different. So, you know, we got to be intentional about that. So anyway.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, there that's just one example of many, you know what I mean? And you're absolutely right. And it's really apparent to people who come from other places and live here and they see that. And, you know, what you spoke to, you know, you said something, you hit the nail on the head. You said, you know, we have to be really intentional about building community, because if you don't do that, you'll be alone in this journey and of life. And that's why in our wellness model, community is one of the seven circles that play a role in how well you are, how connected you are. So, you know, it's a challenge as a Native person to walk in this world, because you are trying to live by the way of your ancestors, because they passed down such a good way of life. And you're trying to maintain that. And oftentimes you're challenged by that dominant society. When you want to start a business, when you want to compete in the business world, when you want to get on social media, a lot of times there's a lot of, the one reason why you don't see a lot of Native American social media influencers is because, and my wife says this really eloquently, she says that social media is the antithesis of indigenous values, because our values are really like based in humility. And I've already accepted, and I'll jokingly say it. I say, I have surrendered my humility, and I've surrendered my teachings about humility. And I go on social media and I boast and I do all these things, you know, I show myself doing these things. I'm boastful, you know? And so and that's the balance
but
we have.
There
to
is
compromise.
Balance there, because like you said, like your communities, while I see that tension, like, we need guys like you, so you know these conversations can happen. Like, I wouldn't have found you if it wasn't for Instagram, you know.
Yeah, it's true. You're right. You're absolutely right. Yeah, and that's kind of why I do things like this. I think, you know, there's got to be somebody in our representing in our, you know, our communities.
Yeah, for sure.
and so, you know, I think that's the biggest challenge. And in Native country, which is why I brought up the '60s earlier. Since then, there's this concept that Native people say is that we have to walk in two worlds, they say. And some say, well, we have 1 foot in each world. And that makes a lot of sense, but I have always tried to blend it and say, you know what, I'm gonna live this hybrid lifestyle. And there's a lot of things I have to compromise for my own way. There's a lot of things I gotta play the game in dominant society to be successful as an entrepreneur. And I have to play that game. But it's a constant nuanced balance. Even when I walk out of the house and I deal with people who are negative and rude, you know, and we're supposed to treat people with kindness, even if they treat you badly, we're supposed to move on, because we don't know what they're going through in their life. We don't engage with that and with how they are. That's their energy they keep. I'm a part of that. That's what our teachings talk about. But I'm challenged all the time as I go through this world and I experience people that, you know, that will make, you know, microaggressive comments about race and such, you know what I mean? About as Native Americans, you know, all the time we experience that on a regular basis. And, you know, you get sick and fed up with it after a while, and you might say something and, you know, you ruffle somebody's feathers. Then all of a sudden you're their aggressor.
Yeah.
All of a sudden they point the finger and I'm in trouble. And so, you know, it's a challenge to walk in this world. And, you know, like I said, I live a hybrid lifestyle. There's a lot of things that our ancestors, when iron came, when the gun came, they embraced it. They embraced the lead and the metal. And in our language, a bow is called a gat, G-A-T, gat is a bow. When the when the rifle came and they said, hey, this shoots faster, it's accurate, I can reload quicker, we're going to use this. They adopted the technological advances. So they called that Weinamgat, means iron shooter of some sort. And we had to change the bow, the word for bow, to Usgat, like a shooter made out of wood. And so, you know, our languages had changed. So today, what I always say, and I'm going to use hunting as a perfect example, and also because this is a hunting podcast, when I share on social media, you know, I'm hunting with a rifle, I'm hunting with a compound bow, I haven't hunted with a longbow in forever, I haven't even killed a big game animal with a longbow, I went straight to the rifle, went straight to the compound bow, and, you know, I use my, you know, Pat by Mystery Ranch, I use Canis Athlete apparel and all these things to get out there and to give me an edge, because I'm out there pursuing this animal nations that they have an edge on you. They they were forged in the Sonoran desert there. I was to a degree, but they're there in 110 degree. They're there bedded. They're there in the cold. When it's dry, they're getting that little bit of moisture from the leaves during the dry season. They are forged there, you know. And I'm out there to try to hunt them and pursue them, and they have an edge. I need all the edge I can get, I feel, because for me, the goal is meat.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how it's done. What to me, well, that does to a degree, and I'll get back to that in a second. What matters is what's the end result. The end result is freezer. Inside your family and friends, enriching yourself with the way, and whatever I got to do to make that happen is I'm going to do to make that happen, as long as it's fair chase, because that's also a part of our cultural values. So I tell people say, yeah, but you're hunting, you're talking about indigenous life ways and indigenous spirituality and hunting, but you're using a compound bow and you're using a rifle. And my response is, that's short-sighted thinking. How it's different is the intention, how I'm doing that, what's in my mind and my heart as I go out there to the desert at dawn. As the sun comes up, I give thanks. You know, that's one of our things that we do in general as all Native people. But I give thanks. You give thanks for the sunlight. You give thanks for the air we're breathing. You give thanks to the water. You give thanks to the fire. You give thanks to the land that you're walking upon. And you give thanks to the animal nations and the plant nations that hold our world together. All of these things play a role in this beautiful interconnected web of life. And to go out there and to show appreciation is to state your place within this world as a human being. You're stating that to the land, because the land is alive. The plants, the land, it's alive. It's a living entity, different than we are. It doesn't have eyes and nose. It may not have a nervous system, but it's living. And when you go out there, you're stating your intention and you're stating who you are within this interconnected web of life, and that you're also stating your intention. And you're out there in a good way to hunt the Kurihua, the mule deer buck, and that you state the intention of, when I harvest him, he's going to be utilized to nourish us. And it's allowing us to get one step closer to sustainability. And how I do it doesn't matter if I do it with a rifle, a longbow, a trap, a pistol, a compound bow, a crossbow. It doesn't matter. What matters is I have meat in the end.
Yeah.
And I say this, of course, you know, on the reservation, we can, you know, hunt with whatever we need to. Of course, if we go on the state side, you know, you draw over the counter archery tag, you obviously can't go out there, you know, with the rifle. But my point is the intention of how the heart and mind is as you're hunting with gratitude, hunting with compassion, having compassion for that animal. And once that animal is down, we sit down and we do it. Different Native people do it different ways, but what I was taught is we make an offering, we offer a song, and we give thanks, and we talk to its spirit and let it know what we're going to do with its body, and we give thanks for it, and we tell it it's time for it to go back to Siardik Vucho, the spirit world, to be with its other animal nations. And I ask them, on my next hunt, I ask you to be with me, help me to think, to see, hear, smell like the Kurihua, the mule deer buck. And when you get the next time I get out in the next season, I get out there. This is why a lot of times I do a lot of solo hunts. It's because I I'm in that zone. I'm in that mindset. I feel like that deer spirit comes into your mind, and his antlers are like antennas, they say in our culture, and they give him that awareness and understanding. That's why the bigger ones are, big bucks because they're intelligent, right? And they say that those big antlers are those. That's also antenna. You know what I mean? You kind of see it out there sometime. You're not even winded, but he'll pop his head up, and he knows his it's his spiritual, his sixth sense. So I always say I want that sixth sense, and I get out there to hunt, and that's what I feel when I'm in it. I'm in the zone, and I'll be glassing one way, and that spirit will come in, and it'll say, "Glass the other way. Look that direction." So I'll turn and make some adjustments, get up on another peak, boom, 5 minutes, we see a bedded buck or, buck trailing some does or something like that. So that's that spirit with you. And I think a lot of guys get it, they just don't know it. But I think you can acknowledge it. So the point is
And
to
learning to
me,
listen to that small voice.
hunter's medicine, we call it in, using English language. And so the goal, how the hunting looks, how it's done is different, but the end goal is the same as it was for my ancestors as it is for me today. So that's living in a hybrid world. That's walking in this world as a native person, utilizing tools from Western technology to your advantage in a way that's culturally appropriate to you. So I think that to me, that might be a good example to answer your question. How do you walk in this world, But it's a constant like this. It's harmony. It's constantly learning to navigate, and some native people have a hard time with that, and some of us just follow our instinct because a lot of it has to do with confidence. And if people have bestowed upon you before in your life, trust your gut, you're doing good, have self-esteem, all your confidence is good, you're doing good, you made a right decision. If that's bestowed upon a person, a lot of times when it comes to a moment where they don't know what to do I go this way or that way in life? And if they listen and they trust the gut, if they listen to that sixth sense, which is a lot of times the spirit, their ancestors telling them, do this, do that. If their mind is open, if they're sober, the consciousness is open, things come into your mind and you say, oh, I'm going to give myself permission to do it like this. And some other native person comes along, are we allowed to do that? Well, I'm giving myself permission to do it because we have to evolve. So a lot of times people don't, they have a challenge, they have a hard time with this. And that's just because they haven't been made confident to make those decisions.
That's just like, how I feel about it with my faith and my walk with God is because I feel like, he has grace to, if you're walking in step with him, that you can confidently make decisions, knowing that it's right because you're doing it in his will. And if it's not, he has enough grace to, as long as you're not, knowingly walking,
Doing it.
picking the evil path or something. Of course, that's not right. But if you're doing your best, just like an earthly father, if your child is trying their best and they do something and they screw it up, you don't like slap them and say, oh, terrible, terrible job, like God's not gonna throw a lightning bolt at you. He might say, no, this is better, or maybe discipline you in certain areas. But just having that confidence that like God is a good father, and that allows you to say, I might stumble, but I will not fall, and that gives you confidence. It's similar to what you were saying. But
Absolutely.
I'm interested, man, like a little bit more, if you don't mind sharing, about your spiritual practice, more in hunting, but also even just like in your daily life, like what that kind of looks like for you, or how you incorporate ceremony and that kind of stuff, and how that is part of your life.
And like a spiritual way of life, as it's something that's shared across many different religions, cultures of the world. And I think that one of the main things for me is remembering that we are spiritual beings, having this human experience. And for me, spirit is involved in everything. It's just a matter of who acknowledges it. And spirit is always it's ubiquitous. It's omnipresent in everything. All living beings have spirit. I believe our spirit is connected to the greater spirit, greater consciousness, right? And I think that that's important to know first and foremost. It's important to know that every decision that we make throughout the day has that spiritual ripple effect. And to think about that, it becomes law within the mind. And then what, how that does is that that affects on autopilot, you know, how we're going through the world, the decisions we make, how we do things. I think that that's first and foremost needs to be adopted, that you're a spiritual being and you're, every day is sort of like a ceremony. It's not just once a week, I think, you know.
Yeah.
And even we share that with a lot of our own people. Remember, you're a spiritual person, not just when you go to a ceremony,
right,
you know, a few times a year, but it's a daily basis. And one of the first things that I do now, it's, you know, I've been doing this for the past like 5 or 6 years. It's really just, you know, it's automatic. When I first wake up in the morning, I always, my first breath, I go, I just breathe in, and it's for a split second, I think about, I'm grateful to have that breath. And that really sets you on a path for the day, you know? And I wake up in the morning and I try to follow the original teachings talking about you wake up with the sun or before the sun. And historically, the people would go outside and they would watch the sun come up and they would give thanks and they would look at it come up. And in our teachings, there's that glow across the horizon is a really sacred and special. It's a really powerful time for us to witness. And as the sun comes up, as the sun is fully up, then that's it. Now it's changing onto a different phase of the day. And I think that's really interesting because, and I brought this up to, you know, Dr. Andrew Huberman, because he talks a lot about that light
It increases dopamine. Chemical. Note I just made was, I read a book that talked about UV light in your retina actually gives a dopamine spike in your brain.
It does. And so, I commented on this on one of his posts and he responded back and then we had a little dialogue and he started following along. I told him, I said, that's really interesting. You're coming up with these findings because culturally is Native people, a lot of us, especially down here in the Southwest, that's what we used to do. And that's what my great grandparents used to do. My dad said, yeah, they'd go outside. They'd look in at the sun coming up in the morning and they would, you know, talk and they'd give thanks, of course, in the language. Sometimes he said they would do it in the evening too, as the sun was going down, those last bit of sun rays. For us, like I said, sun rays are sacred to us. They call it Thash Thonodeg. That's my name. Thash means sun. Thonodeg is the rays. And because they provide, you know, that sunlight is allows all life to be. Just like water does, just like air. So that's why we look at all these different elements, because they allow us to live. So we give thanks for that last bit of sun rays as it goes down. The sun is down. And now as the night comes, that's our signal to be as humans, to go inside with our families and be safe and to enter into sleep, dream time, dream world, to recover. Recovery, our people understood, was really important because they needed that next day. Their survival had depended upon it. So that's why sleep is one of our circles of wellness that we talk about. And we created this wellness model in 2018 before everybody was talking about sleep the way they did and, you know, exposure to sunlight and all that. And so, you know, those are the things I tried to acknowledge when I get up in the morning. I tried to acknowledge that the sun is up and, you know, I try to look at it. What I'll do is my routine before was that I would get up and I'd let my coffee steep in, you know, in the French press. And then I'll sit down and I'll do meditation. Supposed to be 20 minutes, but sometimes I only do it for 10, 15 minutes. And what I do is I open the window depending on the time of the year and I let that light in and I let myself see that light, that it's morning time, it's a new day. And I always ask myself, even if it's for like a conversation for 30 seconds, what is my goal today? What kind of father am I going to be? What kind of man am I going to be today? Am I going to show compassion, empathy today? Am I going to be strong? How do I want to be at the end of the day? I have to give myself those talks because, as we know, we get stressed out. And a lot of times we let our stress parent. We let our stress take over when we are supposed to be doing working. We let our stress take over when we are responding to our spouse. And those are things I don't want to be. I don't want to be like that. I don't want my children to have memories of me being cranky. You know what I mean? I want them to have memories of me talking to their mother in a disrespectful way, you know? And so I'm always really good at checking myself. But that's one of the things I do in the morning is get my mind right and think about today, X, Y, and Z has to get done. And therefore, I have no time to sit around and, you know, mess around on social media. I might jump on and make a post real quick. If I have a busy morning, I jump on and make my post and then, move on with my day. And then I'll come back and respond to comments. But what I don't do is I don't get on social media right away in the morning. I don't get on the email right
Yeah.
away. I don't get on the news right away, because what I'm telling myself is I care more about what's happening in other people's lives than my own. So I get up, and that's one of my rules right there. And like I said, sometimes I will make an exception if I know I have a busy day. If 7:38, the rest of the day is busy, I'm going to jump on and make this post I have planned. But those are some of my routines in the morning. Now we have a small puppy, so now I got to take him outside, which is kind of good because I take him outside right away to go potty in the morning while my coffee steeps. I'll sit outside and I'll really take in that morning light and that morning air, and just really kind of just be grateful for that moment,
Yeah, I
and
love
that
it.
takes you on for the rest of the day, for sure. We have little things that we do throughout the day as well. We have certain types of herbs that we burn for smudging. That carry our thoughts, up. That we kind of do throughout the week when we feel like you really need it, when you're stressed, or if you don't even need to do it when you're stressed, you can do it throughout the house to be proactive. So we do a lot of that. And a lot of times in our home, because our home is a sacred space, we like we'll sing. Like I'll just go in the house or be prepping food and I'll sing one of our songs. Because when you sing and you play any instrument of any sort, any acoustic instrument, it brings in that positive of energy into the room. And I think there's some new science emerging about that, about what it does, how it changes plants, molecular structure. There's a lot of new science emerging from it. So a lot of our indigenous cultural ways, it's not just woo-woo. There's practicality, there's an
Oh,
outcome
yeah.
to it. So that's another thing I'm always trying to share in my journey in life is sharing, because I love science and I love to share when the science is congruent with
Yeah.
our original practices and original teachings. Because I
Yeah.
believe the way forward is blending and marrying those. I believe the way forward for all human beings is blending that indigenous knowledge from wherever you are of the world, or I say pre-industrial knowledge, because even people who lived in the pre-industrial era, like your great grandparents and such, people in those regions right there living in, the mountains and such, they learned how to live with the land, and people were in better health at that time,
Oh,
even
yeah.
just a couple generations back. So it's not just indigenous people. It's people of all walks of life in a pre-industrial era. How do we take that, the practices they did,
Or with
and
like in a
blend it with it?
Judeo-Christian, worldview, like just the people who lived in Bible times when all that stuff, I mean, they were indigenous Middle Eastern people, and they, a lot of the same stuff that you're talking about, just in a different context, is part of that tradition. And I love that too, when like, because to me, science is just like industrialized people explaining what God already told us to do like thousands of years ago, just didn't explain it the same way, so I love that.
And I agree. Science is a mechanism we've created to prove, to provide data and information and a more thorough explanation of what certain people in the world have always known.
Yeah.
Some people don't need the science. I always say, I think it's important. I share with other Native people, because they think that there needs to be this polarizing, narrative between the two. I says, no, we need to blend all this.
Yeah,
They
totally.
complement one another,
Yeah.
because some people need the data to jump on board for buy-in, to
Right.
say, hey, you know what? It is, maybe we need to start bringing in our native practices into our mental health practice.
Yeah. Because, I mean,
People
like,
need to
even
know
stuff you
that.
were saying about, like, gratitude and singing and even going outside in the morning early and meditating, all that stuff is in the Psalms and Proverbs, all over the place.
And I encourage people to look into that, look into that. The few times that I have been in a church setting, and when they read scripture, I listen to it and I'm like, yeah, well, it's not that much different than our ways. That's where I feel people need to build on the similarities that we have. We have these similarities across all cultures, all religions of the world. How do we build on our strengths? Because ultimately, everybody wants the same thing. How do we build upon that and connect? That's why I love hunting, because hunting brings people together of all walks of life. We've all hunted. Hunting is age old. We've been doing that. Hunting is the reason why we've evolved and our brains expanded. Our guts have shrank in the way they did.
That's true. I never thought about it like that. It's kind of one of the very few things that's like in every culture of it, like ties all humans together. Like we all at some point there was hunting in our culture, no matter where in the world. Okay, guys, let's talk about shelters for 1 second. Seek Outside has been making hot tents and stoves since 2010, right there in Grand Junction, Colorado, and I've been using Seek Outside products for about 4 or 5 years now. And the newest one I just added to my lineup is the Courthouse. Now, you guys already know that Seek Outside is famous for their teepees, but the Courthouse is a wall tent, and it's the lightest wall tent on the market and one of the quickest and easiest to set up. So it's great for mobile base camps or even if you just want to go camping with friends or family. But if you guys go to Seek Outside and use the code QUEST, you're going to save 10% on your next order and get the best shelter on the market for a lightweight mobile base camp or a backcountry rip. So check it out and use that code QUEST.
Yep. Hunting, you know, farming, foraging, you know, fighting, music, dance, sex, all that. You know what I mean? Like, that's what we do across the entire world.
Sleeping. Yeah. I love it, man. Well, like I said, we could sit here and probably talk forever. And hopefully there'll be some opportunities we can talk more. Maybe even out in the field a little bit. We'll talk a little bit about more about that. But might be some cool collaborations down the road. We'll see. But where can folks go to check out your book and your fitness content, all the stuff you got going on?
Yeah, so my social media handle, I'm most active on Instagram. It's thosh.collins, thosh.collins. And people can find me on there. And they can do a Google search for our book, The Seven Circles, Indigenous Teachings for Living Well. And that was published by HarperCollins, second largest publisher in the world. So if you do a Google search, you can find out. A local bookstores carry it. It's on Barnes and Noble. It's on Amazon. It's on Target. But we encourage people to support local booksellers, and if you can, support Indigenous booksellers as well. So that's what our book is. It's a template for everyone of all walks of life to follow if they're looking for, you know, another sort of way of looking at health and wellness and thriving. That's a good source. Our Well for Culture is our sort of Indigenous initiative / social entrepreneurship, and you can find more information well WELLFOR culture CULTURE.com wellforculture.com, and cool. Some information right there that we do.
Cool, man. Well, this has been a really cool conversation. Hopefully not the last one. I don't think it will be, but yeah, thanks for your time, man. It's been great chatting with you.
Yeah, thanks, Hunter, for having me on. Like I said, it's a real great opportunity to be able to speak about these topics and to speak within the mainstream hunting community that I say I'm always peeking in on. Yeah. You know, it's a great opportunity to do that. And you know, I really appreciate your views. I appreciate your efforts to have these conversations that a lot of people are not willing to have. I think there is interest, but maybe people don't know how to go about it, but
for sure.
You do. And, you know, you had enough humility to kind of jump in the water and talk about some of these things. And so I respect you for that. And,
man.
I thank you for using your platform and, you know, using your voice to be able to bring up some of these important topics. And I look forward to, getting in the field with you. I look forward to talking about putting into practice some of these things that we talked about and some potential collaboration. So thank you once again.
Yeah, man. All right. Well, we'll talk soon.